translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
The German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
A 70-year-old English grandfather has become the oldest person to row across the Atlantic unassisted. Frank Rothwell broke the world record by completing the 3,000-mile journey in 56 days. Frank rowed from Tenerife in Spain's Canary Islands to Antigua. Such a feat had never been achieved by anyone as old. The septuagenarian sailed across the Atlantic with the aim of raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease and raising £1 million for a UK dementia research charity.
In the UK and other places, I've done a lot of sailing. I've sailed around the world. I've been here 3 or 4 times, sitting in my own yacht. I've sailed around north of America, so within 900 miles of the North Pole. I've sailed around South America, round Cape Horn. I'm the only man in the world to sail all the way around America in a figure of eight. Nobody in the world has ever done that except me. There's only 10 people in the world, only 10 people ever sailed all the way around America. And I'm number 10, or I was 2 years ago. I've not looked up since.
Rothwell has sailed all over the world, including 3 previous journeys across the Atlantic. In 2017, he also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. This shows that to be 70 years young is sometimes far more lively than to be 40 years old.
Well, no matter how old you are, music can always be mesmerizing. In France, a pianist is still addicted to the soft tune of her instrument at the age of 106. Here's more. Colette Mays is a pianist based in Paris. She was born before the start of the First World War and has been playing her favorite instrument for more than a century now. Colette has already released 5 music albums and is now recording her 6th one. The veteran musician says what attracted her to music was a desire for tenderness, which she lacked as a kid at her strict home environment.
In my family, I was raised by a very kind nanny. Mother was very strict. That's how it was at the time, and so I needed tenderness, which was normal. Above where we lived, there were lots of little boys who played the piano. They were always playing the same music. And as a baby, with one finger, I reproduced those melodies. My parents were surprised with that, because playing with dolls didn't amuse me, but playing notes on the piano did. That's why they made me start learning the piano early on.
Well, Colette's favorite musicians are Debussy, Chopin, and Schumann. She looks at the sky for inspiration and says music is more important to her than food. For most of her adult life, Colette has been a supporting piano player at Parisian schools. The dedicated pianist is still marvelously healthy at the age of 106.
Madagascar is the land of outlandish creatures. Biologists have made another tiny discovery in the north of the island. Scientists say Bruchesia nana could be the world's smallest reptile. Also known as nanochameleon, the diminutive lizard measures less than an inch in length. That means it is as small as a sunflower seed and can fit on your fingertip. The reptilian may be tiny, but it has raised a lot of questions as to why it is this small compared to other vertebrates. Also, unlike most reptiles, female nanochameleons are larger than the males. The species is thought to be critically endangered due to mass deforestation.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said working in a healthcare facility without water, sanitation, and hygiene is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment. He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19. But there's still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that financing keeps flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines." Data published by the World Health Organization, WHO, in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the general population, but account for 14% of global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is imperative. We've prepared for you an article written by staff writers of UNICEF.org under the heading, UN report says almost 2 billion depend on health centers without basic water services. Please stay with us for more of UNICEF.org's article. The World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned around 1.8 billion people are at heightened risk of COVID-19 and other diseases because they use or work in healthcare facilities without basic water services. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization Director General, said, working in a healthcare facility without water, without sanitation and hygiene, is akin to sending nurses and doctors to work without personal protective equipment. He said water supply, sanitation, and hygiene in healthcare facilities are fundamental to stopping COVID-19 spreading, but there are still major gaps to overcome, particularly in least developed countries. The report, Fundamentals First, Universal Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene Services in Healthcare Facilities for Safe Quality Care, comes as COVID-19 is exposing key vulnerabilities within healthcare systems, including inadequate infection prevention and control. Water, sanitation, and hygiene are vital to the safety of healthcare workers and patients, yet provision of these services is not prioritized. Worldwide, one in four healthcare facilities has no water services. One in three does not have access to hand hygiene, where care is provided. One in 10 has no sanitation services, and one in 3 does not segregate waste safely. UNICEF Executive Director Henrietta Fore said, sending healthcare workers and people in need of treatment to facilities without clean water, without safe toilets or even soap, puts their lives at risk. She said, this was certainly true before the COVID-19 pandemic, but this year has made these disparities impossible to ignore. As we reimagine and shape a post-COVID world, making sure we are sending children and mothers to places of care equipped with adequate water, sanitation, and hygiene services is not merely something we can and should do. It is an absolute must. The situation is worst of all in the world's 47 least developed countries. One in two healthcare facilities in the least developing countries does not have basic drinking water. One in four healthcare facilities has no hand hygiene facilities at points of care. And three in five lack basic sanitation services. But this can be fixed. The report's preliminary estimate indicates that it would cost roughly $1 per capita to enable all 47 least developed countries to establish basic water service in healthcare facilities. On average, $0.2 per capita is needed each year to operate and maintain services. According to the report, immediate incremental investment in basic water and hygiene and healthcare have big returns. Improving hygiene in healthcare facilities is a best buy for tackling antimicrobial resistance. It reduces healthcare costs because it reduces healthcare-associated infections, which are costly to treat. It saves time as healthcare workers do not have to search for water for hand hygiene. Better hygiene also increases uptake of services. This all adds up to a return of $1.5 for every dollar invested. These services are especially critical for vulnerable populations, including pregnant mothers, newborn babies, and children. Improving water sanitation and hygiene services in healthcare facilities is particularly important around childbirth, when far too many mothers and newborn babies suffer and die, including from preventable conditions. Conditions like sepsis. Better water sanitation and hygiene services could save 1 million pregnant women and newborn babies' lives and reduce stillbirths. The report provides 4 main recommendations. Implement costed national roadmaps with appropriate financing. Monitor and regularly review progress in improving water, sanitation and hygiene services, practices, and enabling environment. Develop capacities to health workforce to sustain water, sanitation and hygiene services and promote and practice good hygiene. Integrate water, sanitation and hygiene into regular health sector planning, budgeting and programming, including COVID-19 response and recovery efforts to deliver quality services. Global water sanitation and hygiene and health partners have shown their support for meeting global and country water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facility targets. By 2020, over 130 partners have committed resources, of which 34 have made dedicated financial commitments totaling $125 million. Nevertheless, implementation of the 2019 World Health Assembly resolution on water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities is uneven. Of the nearly 50 countries for which World Health Organization and UNICEF have data, 86% have updated standards and 70% have conducted initial assessments, which show that these areas are generally on track. Yet just a third of countries have costed national water sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facility roadmaps, and only 10% have included water sanitation and hygiene indicators in national health systems monitoring. More catalytic global funding, technical support, and domestic resourcing is needed to keep healthcare workers and patients safe and protected. Now an opportunity exists to build on existing efforts and commitments and integrate water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities in all national COVID-19 plans, vaccine distribution and economic recovery packages. Jennifer Sara, Global Director for Water at the World Bank Group, said, "For millions of healthcare workers across the world, water is personal protective equipment." She added, "It is essential that finances keep flowing to bring water and sanitation services to those battling the COVID-19 crisis on the front lines. Funding water, sanitation and hygiene in healthcare facilities is among the most cost-effective investments that governments can make. Data published by the World Health Organization in October indicates that COVID-19 infections among healthcare workers are far greater than those in the general population. Healthcare workers represent less than 3% of the population, but account for 14% of the global COVID-19 cases reported to the World Health Organization. Ensuring healthcare workers have the basic water, sanitation, and hygiene necessities to keep themselves, their patients, and their families and children safe is absolutely imperative." Tim Wainwright, chief executive at international charity WaterAid, said, "Millions have no option but to seek care from the 50% of healthcare facilities in the developing world which don't have clean water on the premises. This cannot continue. Every day, both healthcare workers' and patients' lives are being put at risk." Tim Wainwright added, without frontline healthcare workers being able to wash their hands, provide their patients with clean water, or have somewhere decent to go to the toilet, a hospital is not a hospital at all. It's a breeding ground for disease. The data in this year's report includes statistics for 165 countries from surveys representing 760,000 facilities. Compared to last year's baseline report, estimates were available for 125 countries with data from surveys representing 560,000 facilities. The data on county progress in implementing the World Health Assembly's resolution represent 47 countries. It is the first time that these data have been compiled and analyzed.
Aperture.
Every year, hundreds of Americans lose their lives due to violence and shooting. Estimates show that more than 90% of crimes is committed by men. Crimes from mass shooting to murder, armed robbery, and rape. But what is the reason behind this overwhelming amount of violence in American society? I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Perhaps to understand the culture of violent masculinity in America, one must look into the myth that being a real man means putting up a false front and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Stay with us as in this episode of Aperture, Tough Guys provides a stunning look at the violence boys and young men routinely receive from virtually every corner of the American culture. From television, movies, video games, advertising, the sports culture, and U.S. political culture. Don't go away.
Deadliest mass shooting in American history.
They were just joining us. Two young men, apparently dressed in long black trench coats, opened fire at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
When it comes to violence, it's almost like there are two Americas.
It's horrific. You can't put it into words.
There's the America that recoils in horror whenever a brutal mass shooting erupts onto our television screens, shocked by the level of destruction and suffering that just a few individuals are capable of visiting upon so many innocent people.
Police say that the gunman opened fire in a theater during a showing of that latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises.
And then there's the America that can't seem to get enough of violence as a form of entertainment and ritual, a seemingly endless appetite for ever-intensifying spectacles of all-out brutality and carnage. The question is what sort of relationship, if any, these two Americas have to one another. And if we're serious about answering that question, we need to stop chasing symptoms and take a good look at a truth that's been hiding in plain sight all along. That when we talk about violence in America, whether it's real or imaginary, we're almost always talking about violent masculinity. I'm Jackson Katz, and for more than 25 years, I've worked on both a personal and an institutional level to engage men directly in the effort to prevent men's violence against women and children. The reason I work with and focus on men is simple, because for the most part, violence is a men's issue. The statistics tell the story. 86% of armed robberies are committed by men. 77% of aggravated assaults are committed by men. 87% of stalkers are men. 86% of domestic violence incidents resulting in physical injury are perpetrated by men. 99% of rapes are committed by men. Men commit approximately 90% of murder. And over the past 30 years, 61 of the last 62 mass shootings have been committed by men. But while these numbers are striking, they rarely, if ever, come into play in mainstream discussions about violence.
After every event like this, the questions always are the same. What causes this kind of a shooting? How can this happen? How can they be stopped?
During hours and hours of exhaustive reporting, commentators seem to go out of their way to find gender-neutral ways to talk about this violence.
The shooters in Aurora, the shooters in Newtown,
the Connecticut shooter,
the Aurora shooter,
the alleged shooter, teenage psychopath,
mass murderers,
the suspect,
that kid,
this punk,
this murderer.
The male perpetrators become shooters or murderers or assailants or killers or suspects or psychopaths.
It's kids killing kids in the heart of America.
Violence committed by boys becomes kids killing kids and youth violence.
Here is a revealing and frankly horrifying picture of youth violence in America.
It doesn't seem to matter that girls are kids and youth too, but only commit a fraction of these kinds of crimes. And this baseline failure to acknowledge gender has a big effect when the discussion turns to other supposed causes of violence.
Violence in the entertainment culture.
Bloody games, gory movies, brutal TV shows.
Call of Duty or Halo.
Mental health issues, the faith issues.
Autism or Asperger's syndrome.
You're blaming the gun.
Their mom and their dad.
Substance abuse.
Mental health, violent games, violent movies.
I want to blame the real culprit.
Alex.
Suicide pills.
Alex.
Mass murder pills.
We hear very little, if anything, about why it is that girls and women also live in a culture saturated with guns and media violence, also suffer from mental illness, also come from dysfunctional families and have substance abuse problems, yet don't commit anywhere near the amount of violence boys and men do. In other cases, the perpetrators disappear altogether.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
You see this a lot in the mainstream discussion about so-called violence against women. The fact that men are responsible for somewhere around 98% of this violence simply evaporates. We hear about women being harassed, abused, assaulted, or raped. Men are nowhere to be found. And the result of all this is that instead of seeing men's violence against women as a men's issue, we see it as a women's issue and focus most of our attention on how to help victims and survivors after the fact. A failure all the more glaring given that mainstream media outlets have no problem at all taking gender seriously when women are the ones doing the violence.
Teenage girls involved in violent fights.
A fight between two young girls breaks out on the playground.
More and more teenage girls are getting involved in violent fights.
When girls and women act out violently, their gender becomes the story. The same way race becomes the story with men of color.
The horrific murder rate in Chicago. Does it have to do with guns or race?
When men of color rape women or shoot people or blow things up, race and culture move to the forefront of the story, crowding out the fact that the vast majority of the perpetrators under consideration, no matter what color they are men. All of this is partly a function of how dominant ideologies work linguistically to conceal the power of dominant groups. For example, when we hear the word race in the United States, we tend immediately to think about African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, Pacific Islanders, South Asians. And when we hear the term gender, we tend to think of women. In each case, the dominant group, white people, men, don't get examined. As if white people don't belong to some racial grouping, as if men don't have a gender. In other words, we always focus on the subordinated group and not on the dominant one. And that's one of the ways that the power of dominant groups isn't questioned. By remaining invisible.
There are young men involved in these things. There's a lot of testosterone there.
And on those rare occasions when the subject of men does make its way into mainstream discussions about violence, there's this common refrain that men's violence is all about testosterone and our prehistoric role as hunter-warriors were just programmed to be violent.
What is it about the testosterone of being a young man that makes this come to this gun violence head so often?
Why does it seem that these mass shooters are boys? And not girls.
Really, it goes back to hunter-gatherer days.
Yeah. You hear another version of this in the common refrain, boys will be boys.
Let boys be boys. They want to play rough. Don't try and over-medicate them and, you know, turn them into girls. They're boys.
No one would deny that there are biological factors that sometimes come into play with violence. The problem is when biological arguments lead people to conclude that men are just beasts who are overcome by hormonal urges they can't control, that men are incapable of making moral and ethical decisions, that boys are born hardwired to bully, rape, and murder. But perhaps the most damaging thing this kind of thinking does is that it blinds us to the fundamental role that cultural systems play in all of this.
This is a document signed by six of the major public health organizations saying that
the violence and the entertainment, the level that we've attained to today, is causing increased aggressive behavior among some children.
For decades, experts and government officials have been arguing that we need to take a closer look at the relationship between violence in the culture and violence in the real world.
And in the days since the heartbreaking tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, I also tasked the Vice President with leading an effort to come up with a comprehensive set of serious proposals to keep our children safe, including strengthening school safety, improving mental health care, and addressing a culture that too often glorifies guns and violence.
This focus on the culture of violence in America took on new and bipartisan urgency in the wake of Adam Lanza's cold-blooded murder of 20 children and 6 adults at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. But unfortunately, it quickly descended into a distracting and false debate between defenders of the gun industry and defenders of the entertainment industry.
There exists in this country, sadly, a callous, corrupt, and corrupting shadow industry that sells and stows violence against its own people through vicious, violent video games.
On one side, we've had the gun industry blaming movies and video games.
We have blood-soaked films out there, like American Psycho, Natural Born Killers, that are aired like propaganda loops on splatter days and every single day.
On the other side of the debate, we've had the entertainment industry blaming the NRA and guns.
Can we not do a better job on controlling the weapons of violence that get to the wrong hands?
What both sides have failed to mention is how for years they've been mutually reinforcing parts of the same culture of violence and have profited handsomely from one another. And the reason this matters so much is that while we've been debating whether guns or movies and video games are more to blame for violence, we've missed what the culture teaches boys about what it means to be a man. We often talk about violence being a learned behavior, but it's more to the point to say that it's a taught behavior. And by shifting the focus from learned to taught, we shift the onus of responsibility onto those of us who are teaching our sons what it means to be a man. Since the 1970s, sociologists and other researchers have identified a consistent set of messages the culture sends boys about what it means to be a real man. William Pollack introduced the idea of a boy code in which boys are taught from a very early age to act tough and not show their feelings. Michael Kimmel extended the reach of the boy code into late adolescence and young adulthood, where he describes a guy code in which young men police each other into conformity with dictates about manhood that come with an implicit and sometimes explicit warning. Don't slip up or you risk being unmasked and found out as someone who doesn't measure up. The result is that guys are put into a box that turns out to be the perfect breeding ground for violence. We can't show any emotion except anger. We can't think too much or seem too intellectual. We can't back down when someone disrespects us. We have to show we're tough enough to inflict physical pain and take it in turn. We're supposed to be sexually aggressive with women. Anything short of full-scale emotional shutdown becomes a source of humiliation and shame. And in response, young men learn to adopt what I call the tough guys, the front so many young men put up to shield their vulnerabilities and avoid being ridiculed. But it doesn't just come from their peer groups. It comes from fathers, coaches, and older male role models as well. Eastwood's character, like so many fathers, father figures, coaches, and other men in boys' lives, assumes the role of the director and proceeds to evaluate how well the young man performs his role. It doesn't matter how unnatural, complicated, or ridiculous the role is, boys are expected to learn their lines and master the tough guys, or else risk being shamed as less than a man. A pair of animated films show very clearly how this process is passed down intergenerationally.
Lenny, you see something, you kill it, you eat it, period. Thanks. That's what sharks do. That's a fine tradition. What's the matter with you?
Right here in front of me now, eat this.
In Shark Tale, the father shark makes it clear to his son, who is a vegetarian, that he has no choice but to conform to shark norms and become carnivorous and aggressive.
Frankie, I want you to take Lenny out, show him the ropes.
Oh, come on, Pop.
Son, you're gonna learn how to be a shark, whether you like it or not.
I'm gonna kill you, Dragon.
Similarly, in How to Train Your Dragon, the son of a Viking leader runs into problems when he refuses to act violently. And the unwillingness of the boy to use violence causes a crisis in his relationship with his warrior father.
I don't want to fight dragons.
Come on, yes you do.
Who can't even comprehend that his son might not want to follow in his violent footsteps. Qualities like compassion, caring, empathy, intellectual curiosity, fear, vulnerability, even love. Basic human qualities that boys have inside them every bit as much as girls do. Get methodically driven out of them by a sexist culture that labels these things unmanly, feminine, womanly, and teaches boys to avoid them at all costs. And most importantly, they're taught that real men turn to violence not as a last resort, but as the go-to method of resolving disputes. And also as the primary means of winning respect and establishing masculine credibility.
Andy Peon on KRES Radio, the voice of the Coeur d'Alene Indian Reservation.
In the groundbreaking film Smoke Signals, one of the first features produced by Native Americans, there's a memorable scene where an older kid tries to teach a younger kid how to be a real-life Hollywood Indian. The scene is funny, but it also shows how the pressure to conform to ideals of violent masculinity cuts across racial, ethnic, and class lines. As the sociologist Richard Majors has pointed out, African-American and other men of color in urban areas often adopt a hyper-masculine, menacing persona he calls the cool pose to signal that they're still men, regardless of what else has been stripped from them. This is also true with Latino men,
checkmate, puto,
who are disproportionately portrayed in Hollywood as gangbangers, Mexican drug lords, and thugs in the barrio, images that are crude stereotypes, but which nonetheless have become symbols of toughness to some poor and working-class Latinos whose manhood has been undermined by class exploitation and ethnic discrimination. And we see the same thing when it comes to Asian masculinity. In American popular culture, Asian men have long been emasculated, stereotyped as ineffectual, desexualized, and unmanly. But since the early 1970s, running counter to this long line of neutered stereotypes is the highly stylized physicality and violence of the martial arts. But young Asian American men don't just have to look to Bruce Lee for cues. Increasingly, we've seen the phenomenon of Asian guys adopting the tough guy street styles of African American and Latino men to establish their masculine credentials. Middle-class white boys may not have a lot of experience with the kind of real-world inner-city conditions that gave rise to the cool pose, but the culture tells them if they take on this black, urban, hard guy pose, they'll somehow be more real, more of a man. What makes this even more interesting is that a lot of the very guys they see as models of authenticity are themselves projecting an image they picked up from the culture. As the writer Nathan McCall has said, he and some of his African-American male cohorts got some of their ideas of manhood from The Godfather and other gangster films that featured tough, ruthless, white Italian gangsters. And the same kind of thing about Scarface.
It's one of the hottest movies ever made.
This is the all-time greatest movie.
Never seen nothing like that.
I watched this movie 63 times.
It's a comic book. So we have this interesting phenomenon where we have white middle-class males emulating poor urban black males who in turn are getting part of their idea about manhood from gangster films featuring white men who are playing Italian and Cuban-American gangsters.
Now are we made or are we made, man?
The paradox is that the test of being real somehow comes down to how well you live up to a made-up script. And it's a script that's only become increasingly violent over time. The American ideal of the real man owes a lot to the Hollywood Western and the ultimate icon of white American masculinity, John Wayne.
Young fella, if you're looking for trouble, I'll accommodate you.
While other men talked a lot, thought too much, equivocated, and showed emotion, John Wayne made the world bend to his will with just a stare, a few words, his fists, and his guns.
I haven't lost my temper in 40 years, but Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth, but I won't.
And then there's Hollywood gangster films with cinematic tough guys like James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart.
Don't move out of you, son. I'll fill your pants full of lead. Get over there.
Men hardened by the world who knew the power of a few clipped words and a few rounds of ammunition. And this equation between toughness, manhood, and violence has continued and in many ways intensified over time. There's no question that over the past few decades, there's been a ratcheting up of what it takes to be considered a real man. Our action heroes. In the 1950s, Superman was the equivalent of an ordinary guy running around in tights and a cape. And today, he's pumped up and ripped. Well, Batman. The body of Adam West as Batman in the 1960s is a far cry from the far more imposing Dark Knight of the 21st century. Pro wrestlers' bodies in the 1960s were more flabby. In the 21st century, they're way more sculpted, pumped up, and ripped. And look at toy action figures. If you look at the Star Wars toy figurines that kids played with in the 1970s and contrast them with the Star Wars toy figurines that are being marketed to kids today, you see a dramatic shift. Well, the body of G.I. Joe. A study done in the late 1990s found that over the past 50 years,
the size of G.I. Joe's biceps in real-life equivalents increased from 12.2 inches in 1964 to 15.2 inches in 1974 to 16.4 inches in 1994 and up to 26.8 inches by 1998. If you wanted a comparison to a real person, the biceps of someone like The Rock are reportedly only about 20 inches. We can see a similar pattern in the changing level of violence itself over time. We've gone from pistols in the 1940s to larger weaponry in the 1970s to the increasing militarization of these weapons in the 80s and 90s to the larger-than-life heavy metal killing machines we have today. We've seen video game violence go from the benign aggressions of Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and Asteroids to the unimaginable and hyper-realistic bloodbaths of today's game. We've gone from the comparatively orderly sport of boxing to today's number one fighting sport, the street fighting viciousness of mixed martial arts and cage fighting. Now, there's no doubt we're in the throes of some kind of a crisis in masculinity. But rather than questioning whether it's our inability to move beyond the straitjacket of traditional masculinity that might be the source of this crisis, across the cultural and political landscape, there's been a growing movement to reclaim and reassert traditional manhood.
We need to toughen up and stand up for ourselves and learn to be a lot tougher than yoga is going to teach us to do all by ourselves.
The basic idea is that men are in crisis because women have been waging a full-scale war on traditional manhood.
We've been so emasculated by a so-called women's movement at this point. Even our strongest men are acting girly.
The whole culture is being feminized, in my opinion.
There's a certain emasculation that's happening in our culture.
Part of the problem is we've sort of feminized schools.
I think she's right. It's 100%. We're wussifying America.
Is this the wussification of America?
Yes, this is one more step in the wussification of America.
Is this the latest in the wussification of America?
The result is a narrative that tells men that the best way to respond to change is not to adapt, but to reclaim traditional masculine control and dominance from the forces of feminization.
The founding fathers were men, not wussies. It's the wussification of America that's killing us.
And as it turns out, this is an old pattern in American history. Take the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouting is one of the few institutions to balance the rather softening effect of our modern way of life.
This is IRIB English Radio.
English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The Islamic Revolution returned democracy to the Iranian people and allowed the masses to vote on the future direction of their nation in a referendum on turning the nation into the Islamic Republic. According to official results, the people overwhelmingly voted in favor of an Islamic Republic, approved by 98.2% of eligible voters in Iran. We now present you an article in this regard written by Robert Carter. The piece is titled, Why the Muslim World Needs More Islamic Revolutions. Please stay with us for more of Robert Carter's article. Despite what Western media claims, Iranians have benefited tremendously from the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and other Muslim nations could too. before the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, returned from exile in Paris to jubilant scenes in Tehran, Iran was a country plagued with many issues. In particular, the former regime of the Shah refused to distribute wealth to those most in need and deprived millions of Iranians of the chance to have a better life. Just as is the case in many Muslim countries today, oppressive regimes with Western support are preventing their people from excelling. But why? So Western imperialists keep their goons in power and defend the regional interests of non-Muslim powers. Iran's Islamic Revolution liberated Iranians from sharing the same fate as many Arab peoples face today. The following are just a few areas in which Iran extinguishes itself thanks to the Islamic Revolution. Education. Education among women and poor class families was shockingly low before the Islamic Revolution. According to the World Bank's report, the age group of 15 to 95, only 36% of Iranians were literate in 1979, while the global average was 69%. Other research said illiteracy among Iranian women may have been as low as 17% at certain points. However, following the Islamic Revolution, illiteracy in Iran has been totally eradicated. Not only that, but Iran has even begun leading the way in the fields of science, arts, poetry, sports, cinema, and so on, with Iranians achieving noteworthy successes on the world stage. Whether it is winning medals at the Olympics, for wrestling, or producing the first female mathematician to win a Fields Medal, Iran is producing significant talent thanks to the Islamic Revolution's emphasis on education for all. A self-reliant economy. Those countries who are hostile towards Islamic Iran would claim that the revolution damaged Iran's economy and isolated the Islamic Republic from the rest of the world. I can't deny that Iran has been the victim of a campaign of cruel and illegal sanctions, which produce hardship. However, the wise response to this challenge by Iran's revolutionary leadership was to invest in Iran's domestic abilities. Dubbed the resistance economy, Iran has become largely self-sufficient and is now capable of holding out against the economic terrorism which imperialist powers utilize. Many products and services Iranians produce domestically to avoid relying on foreign exports. The most recent example of this is Iran's quickfire work on two COVID-19 vaccines, which are currently in the human trial stage. The production of these vaccines by the hands of Iran's science and medical professionals will ensure Iranians don't have to rely on vaccines from hostile nations. Hence the ban on imports of British, American, and Israeli equivalents. Islamic democracy and constitution. Before 1979, Iranians were ruled by the dictatorial monarch, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who was installed as the Shah in 1953, when the British and the Americans backed a coup d'etat which saw the overthrow of the democratically elected Prime Minister of Iran at the time, Mohammad Mossadegh. The Islamic Revolution returned democracy to Iranians and even allowed the masses of Iranians to vote on the future direction of their nation in a referendum on turning the nation into an Islamic Republic. According to official results, the people overwhelmingly voted in favor of an Islamic Republic, approved by 98.2% of eligible voters in Iran. What followed next was a constitution which secured the rights of all Iranian citizens inside the country, including religious freedoms for all and the right to vote for women, two basic principles the former regime failed to enforce. Now, Iranians can vote for their government, they can vote for their president, and even their religious representatives, all thanks to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. domestic defense and the defense industry. Iran is currently ranked as one of the strongest military forces in the world, with Forbes ranking the Islamic Republic in the top four of their top 10 list of strongest West Asian military forces in 2019. Iran produces everything from its tanks, armored vehicles, and defensive ballistic missiles. They have a navy which includes Iranian-built ships, boats, and even submarines. The Islamic Revolution gave Iranians their freedom, integrity, and democracy. Now it produces the elements needed for the protection of its people. Iran's military, particularly the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, has been accredited with defeating both Daesh terrorists and Al-Qaeda terrorists across the region, including in Iraq and Syria. Not a bad record, given that the Islamic Republic has never started a war since its inception. The list could go on, but my point has been made. So many of Iran's neighbors are in bad shape, and the reason for this stems from the fact that they are under the wing of non-Muslim imperialist powers, which don't have the region's best interests at heart. Poverty, corruption, and oppression are rife in the region and the world, particularly in the Arabian Peninsula, an area which lacks democracy, it lacks human rights, and security, despite the fact that the United States and Britain are close allies. When the oil runs out, how long will the Western-backed regimes in the Arab world last? That is a question which Iran doesn't have to worry about, because thanks to the Islamic Revolution, Iran is self-sufficient, Iran is well-defended, and free. The sapling of the Islamic Revolution, nurtured by the blood of more than 60,000 martyrs, finally bore fruit after years of unrelenting and continuous struggle amidst the cries of independence and freedom. With the collapse of the oppressive monarchic system and the defeat of domestic tyranny, the Iranian people succeeded in annihilating the calculations, relations, and institutions of imperialism. The 1979 Islamic Revolution opened a new chapter in the history of resistance and mass popular revolutions in the world. The determinative characteristic of this revolution, compared to other uprisings of the world during the 20th century, is its ideological and Islamic nature. After experiencing the anti-despotic constitutional demonstration and the anti-colonial uprising for the nationalization of oil, the Muslim nation of Iran learned the invaluable lesson that the specific and essential reason for the failure of those uprisings was the non-doctrinal quality of the struggles. The alert conscience of the nation, under the precious leadership of the source of religious emulation, the exalted Grand Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, identified the necessity for following the path of an authentic, doctrinal, and Islamic uprising. The uprising of the Iranian nation has been not only about Western exploitation of national resources, but rather an intersection of many different issues, such as discrimination, marginalization, and most importantly, from a broader perspective, the hostility of liberal imperialism in monopolizing force, justice, and truth to the benefit of the powerful. History evolves to resolve. It develops through a dialectical process for real to become rational and rational to become real. Thus, the Islamic society has become the physical manifestation of the spirit of the Islamic Revolution, as individual conscience has risen to its height against oppression and exceptionalism. That alone pretty much explains political Islam and sets the agenda for its foreign policy vis-a-vis an international society that up to its waist is in the stomach of neoliberal dominion. Now, for more than a century, communities are subordinated as periphery to the imperialist core. Neoliberalism advocates for a system of division of labor under which the West would contribute technology, or rich states, capital and market, and other nations' labor. Islamic Iran has been launching satellites into orbit quite for some time now. The imposition of imperialist borders has divided the people with the same history, culture, and language as a divide and rule strategy. The Islamic Revolution has given them a supranational identity. If invasion, occupation, and plunder objectively are judged as evil, in such a context, resistance shouldn't be merely seen as a political necessity, but rather as a moral duty. Therefore, the Islamic Republic faces the task it ideologically is based upon, resisting oppression and defending the oppressed. The Islamic Revolution is young at 42 years old. A year after it was born, both superpowers of the then bipolar world order, the United States and the former Soviet Union, started backing the Iraqi dictator Saddam and his campaign of bombing Iranian cities with chemical weapons of mass destruction he owned from the West. But the Islamic Revolution never bandwagoned with any superpowers. It withstood alone and defended its ideals with an unbelievable resolution. The Islamic Revolution changed the structure of international politics. Therefore, the faithful Iranian people believe there is no power nor strength except in Allah, the Lofty, the Great.
Around the world with reporters.
These kind of actions calling for the boycott of Israeli products will not be possible anymore if the French Minister of Justice, Dupont Moretti, succeeds in his intentions. In a letter, he instructed all prosecutors, magistrates, and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products because it is a discrimination against the nation, he says. But an important group of French people reacted publicly, stating that BDS is legitimate and legal. In June last year, the European Court for Human Rights said that boycott is a legal political weapon. Pierre Stamboul is member of the board of the French Jewish Union for Peace and a BDS activist. His father was deported by the Nazis.
En France comme aux États-Unis, il y a une...
In France and in the USA, many Jews are involved in the BDS movement because Israel and the Zionist movement commit crimes against the Palestinians. The Israeli policy is an insult to our memory, our history, and our identity. Today, we see that France is again complicit with Israel. But nevertheless, France has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights to pay 100,000 euros to BDS activists who organized the boycott action.
For lawyer Dominique Cochin, the judgment of the European Court prevails over the French directives.
That means that France is committed to respect the judgments of the European Court of Human Rights. Minister Moretti pretends to obey this judgment. It says in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights that the boycott is a totally legitimate political way of expression. But the French Minister of Justice, with this letter, tries again to criminalize the appeal to boycott.
The appeal to BDS has been launched by the Palestinians in 2005 and had a support all over the world, with remarkable events also in France, with actions in supermarkets or boat protests against the inauguration of a Ben Gurion square. They asked the end of the colonization and occupation of Palestine. The French Minister of Justice would like BDS activists to appear in courthouses to be condemned for criticizing Israel. That will not be easy because most lawsuits against BDS are won by the activists till now. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The clashes between the police and the government employees in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. The security forces use excessive tear gas to prevent opposition-backed protesters who government fears could have besieged country's parliament. They demanded the government to raise their salaries by 40% to compensate them over massive price hike and inflation after Pakistan devalued its currency under an intense IMF pressure.
Tear gas and the lathi charge, that is really shameful because we are not terrorists. Our salaries should be increased, should be competitive because when Imran Khan government took charge, inflation rate, you can see 300% inflation rate has been high and increased during the